Today we continue with the fourth program in our series on the Radio Cafe, Thinking Like a Watershed, a series of panel discussions that focus on responses to the water crisis in the West. Each panel is intended to provide a variety of cultural perspectives concerning global warming and climate change. They are produced and moderated by author and oral historian Jack Leffler. Today's panel features author and law professor M. Hall from the University of New Mexico, Bruce Frederick from the New Mexico Environmental Law Center, and Peter Pino from Zia Pueblo.
Good evening, and thank you all so very much for coming here this evening. This is panel number four in Thinking Like a Watershed, Water Crisis in the West. As Craig said, our whole point is really to try to, over the whole span of five panels, to create kind of an overview or a sphere of reference about aspects of what we have to think about when we're thinking about water problems, but also some of the reasons for these water problems that we have. And it seems that tonight is a particularly important panel because it focuses on water law in the American Southwest. And the original concept was to try to give a sense of the evolution of water law in the American Southwest, and that would take several days. It's actually one of the most complex subjects we can possibly imagine. But we have some really great folks tonight, people who really understand water law, who can speak concisely. We have with us tonight M. Hall, who used to work with the State Engineer's Office, who has taught very long and well at UNM. We have Bruce Frederick, who is currently with the New Mexico Environmental Resource Department. And then from the Zia Pueblo, to speak to us about Native American perspectives concerning water, is Peter Pino, who is a former tribal administrator at the Zia Pueblo. And these three people really have an awful lot to say, so I'm now going to sit down, shut up, and bring out our panelists. And thank you all for coming, and thank you for being such a loyal audience. And now I'd like to introduce our panelists. This is Bruce Frederick.
Hi.
From the New Mexico Environmental Law Center. This is Peter Pino from the Zia Pueblo. And here we have M. Hall, wonderful fellow.
He's the one trying to turn on his microphone.
So, without further ado, each of our panelists will speak for 10 or so minutes this evening about perspectives that they feel are important to talk about. And we're going to start this evening with M. Hall.
Thank you, Jack. When Jack asked me to come talk to one of these wonderful sessions that he's been putting on, I asked him what he wanted me to talk about. And he said, why don't you talk about water law for 10 minutes? And I thought about that for a second because water lawyers, once they get started on water law, have a lot of trouble stopping after 10 minutes or 10 hours. So I'm going to try to do my best to stick to 10 minutes tonight, but it won't be easy. I thought that one way I should try to do that maybe is to figure out who was the wisest man I ever knew who could say something about water law. And that turned out to be Steve Reynolds, for whom I worked, and he was a state engineer for a long, long time in New Mexico and had more of an influence on New Mexico water law than anybody else. And when I started my career as a water lawyer, I went to Reynolds and said, what can you tell me about the relationship between water and law? And he said to me, water is intricately and extensively regulated by law. That's all he said. And the reason Reynolds said that was because he was warning me to stay out of the water business until I got some of the vocabulary together. I do want to say that there's a lot of, especially in New Mexico water law, a lot of magic language. And if you want to talk to the water bureaucrats and the water lawyers in New Mexico, you got to try to learn some of that language. I think of groundwater and the language of groundwater, which involves what you would normally think of as being Esalen Institute talk about sustained yield, about cones of depression, about different kinds of groundwater performance. It really sounds like psychological terms, parapsychological terms. I think that one of the things that we really have to do, and that I'm trying to do tonight, is to get beyond that, to get beyond the secret language of New Mexico water and down to the basics of what's going on and how it works. When Reynolds said that New Mexico water was intricately and extensively governed by law, what he was really referring to was the 1908 Water Code that was the basis for New Mexico's whole system of administering water rights for a long time. What's happened today is that those central concepts in the 1908 Water Code have been surrounded and embedded in a whole lot of other legal doctrines that compete. Those include interstate compacts. No state water rights attach until all interstate obligations are fulfilled. There are supreme federal laws, that is, supreme in the sense of being superior to state law by virtue of being federal government law. And those include things that didn't exist in 1908, like the Endangered Species Act, like the Environmental Protection Act, like the Clean Water Act. You have Native American rights, which exist as a matter of federal law and outside entirely of the state water systems. But what you have going on is a central body of state law surrounded by very different bodies of federal law working in very different ways. And the relationship between the doctrines, even if we understand them completely, are also undefined. And I remind you what happened when the San Juan Chama Project water came up to greet the Endangered Species Act, and all hell came loose as to which of those rights were superior under what circumstances. You've got a very complex system going on, and these doctrines in water law struggling with each other all the time in ways that we don't know what their outcome's going to be. At the same time, the natural circumstances with which those rights deal are changing. Those changes are going to be exacerbated by our insistence on developing and mining groundwater. That is, taking more water out of groundwater aquifers than out of recharge, which is always happening. Those combinations are going to make the put more and more pressure on this complex system that's relatively unadjusted. So things are pretty much in chaos today. If things get a lot worse, it's going to be this sort of, people have been predicting it for years, this catastrophic collision between the natural systems that are reducing and the legal systems which are trying as best they can to govern the system through a system of water laws. Some people have said we should just junk the whole thing, the whole legal system, all of these embedded rights, the state rights underneath it, and we should just start again. It won't happen here because of the property rights that belong to people under the existing system. I don't think it'll happen here because the politics of water is so difficult that to get something like that through the state legislature would never happen. So I think that what we're trying to do is find a system that's flexible enough to adjust itself to these changes that are coming with respect to supply and availability of water. And one of the things that I'd like to talk about tonight is the possibility that the much maligned 1907 Water Code itself may provide the kind of flexibility that would allow some regulation of the water supply without catastrophically destroying the whole thing. Let me just say this about the 1907 Water Code. It was based on the premise that you could secure entitlements to water by taking water from where it naturally occurred and applying it to use somewhere else. That's the whole basis of the 1907 Water Code. And it is incredibly offensive to those people who are interested in the integrity of natural resource systems. But the 1907 Code has provided some flexibility. In the 1925 to about 1935, they took the 1907 Surface Water Code, that is, it was a code that only applied to rivers, and applied it to groundwater. Then between 1955 and about 1970, Reynolds combined the two and said, not only are we going to treat these resources as covered by the basic legal rules, but we're also going to recognize that they are interrelated geologically and physically. So under the 1907 Code, there has been some power to make adaptations to change circumstances. And so I'm sort of interested in the possibility that the great values will come not from federal law, and they've helped a lot, but from actually moving state law into a more ecologically friendly way than it has been before. And when I think about doing that, I think about the basic foundations of New Mexico water law. And they're embodied, interestingly enough, in Article 16 of the state constitution. Most western states don't have their water provisions in the state constitutions. New Mexico does. And really, Article 16 says a couple of things that are important. One is it says that the unappropriated water belongs to the public. It's a declaration in a complex way of a continuing public interest in water, even that's fully privatized. The other part of it is Section 3 that says that beneficial use shall be the basis, the measure, and the limit of a right to water. Beneficial use isn't defined in the state constitution, but the courts have said pretty much is that the state legislature can define beneficial use in whatever way it seems best. It seems to me that it's possible that beneficial use could be extended, as have these other areas, in order to incorporate the economic and ecological and sustainable use of water as itself a fundamental beneficial use under the Constitution. We finally agreed that water in place in a river can be a beneficial use of water. The old guys would have rolled over dead. The best Montana River in the 1950s was a river without water in it, because that meant that everything was being used for beneficial use. The other, we're making small avenues with respect to that. The second one that comes up is the recent New Mexico appellate court's recognition of the existence of a non-consumptive beneficial use. The old water buffaloes, guys like Steve Reynolds, would roll over in their graves at the idea that you could have a use that was non-consumptive. This is a recognition that maybe you can have uses in the river that are beneficial uses themselves. Those two concepts, that is the public nature of water and beneficial use as a basic ecological system, may allow us to move forward toward a more responsive, flexible system of water law. So thank you very much. That's my pitch. And
that's great. Thank you, Em. Now, Em knows so much. One of the things I'd like to quickly mention is that New Mexico, relatively speaking, has less surface water than any other state. We have about 121,000 square miles of land area, and we have only about 230 square miles of surface water. Now I want to reintroduce Bruce Frederick, who has done a magnificent thing down in the plains of St. Augustine. And so I'd like to welcome Bruce. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Jack. I want to thank you for inviting me on this panel with him and Peter. It's a real honor. I'm with the Environmental Law Center, New Mexico Environmental Law Center. We're in Santa Fe. I'm a lawyer, of course. Currently, I represent about 80 people in a fight over water in Catron County, New Mexico, that's been going on for about 7 years. The fight centers on an application to privatize a very large public supply of groundwater. This case is far from over. Right now it's pending in the Court of Appeals, and ultimately it's probably going to be decided in the New Mexico Supreme Court. The fight in Catron County, I think, is relevant, generally relevant, because in my opinion it illustrates what is the classic struggle between private and public interests in Western water. Catron County also highlights, and I'm with M on this, because I don't think the prior appropriation system is totally evil. I think, and the Catron County case actually highlights the aspects of prior appropriation, the positive aspects of that system that tend to be overlooked. So the fight in Catron County and actually throughout the West, in my opinion, is over control of water. And on the one side of that are what I'll just characterize as foreign speculators. What they all have in common is that they want to acquire and monopolize, really, Western water supplies, and not for their own use, but for sale to third parties. On the other side of that fight are local people who actually use and depend on the water for their livelihood. And those are people in Catron County. Unlike the speculators, the locals usually don't have a lot of money or a lot of power on their side. What is on their side, at least so far, at least up to this point, is the law of prior appropriation. And as M pointed out, New Mexico's constitution, like some other constitutions in Western states, declares that water belongs to the public, and the technicality there, it's the unappropriated water, belongs to the public. I view that as water in streams. If it's in the stream or if it's in the ground, it's public water and it's subject to regulation. And that means, no, you can't privately own water in the ground or water in a stream. You have the right to divert it, but you can't own the water itself, and that's actually a distinction that does make a difference. Unfortunately, that's never stopped, and there's been many cases throughout history. It's never stopped speculative investors from trying to privatize public water. Hope springs eternal there. No pun intended, I guess. Catron County is really a case in point, and it's just one example of many. In the 1980s, a wealthy, and I'm not making any of this up, wealthy Italian speculator named Bruno Modena and his son, Vittorio, decided to buy a large ranch in Catron County, New Mexico. We know next to nothing about Bruno or Vittorio. We know some rumors, but there's really no hard information about these people. We just know they're Italian and they're wealthy, and actually, we don't even really know that. We don't even know if they really exist. I've seen the name on some paperwork, that's all. The ranch they bought in New Mexico is real. It's located between Dattle and Magdalena along Highway 60, just east of the very large array. The Modenas purchased that ranch in the name of a corporation called Augustin Plains Ranch. Augustin Plains Ranch, Inc. Is the only New Mexico corporation I've come across that has a New York Fifth Avenue address. Probably because that's a more attractive address to investors than Dattle, New Mexico. The corporate name, however, is local, and it comes from a landform in New Mexico in Catron County known as the Plains of San Augustine. Viewed from above, if you look at a topo map or you happen to be in a spaceship, you'll see the Plains of San Augustine look like a tilted, kind of a right-tilted, oval-shaped basin And the ranch is located right in the northeastern portion of that basin. The basin was formed by a large freshwater lake that dried up about 10,000 years ago. Lake existed in that location because precipitation in that area was once a lot greater than it is today. We've long suspected that much of this ancient precipitation is stored up as groundwater in the basin-fill aquifers that lie underneath the plains of San Augustine. These aquifers are potentially thousands of feet thick in some places, and Bruno and Vittorio were obviously informed that the aquifers underneath the ranch they were purchasing potentially comprised a vast and largely untapped water supply. They eventually hired a hydrologist, and based on some preliminary studies, this hydrologist informed the Medenas that they could mine 54,000 acre-feet of water from the basin every year and not run out of water for 300 years. That in itself is probably wild speculation, but that's what their application states. 54,000 acre-feet is a lot of water. It's about 18 billion gallons of water per year. That's enough to serve, conservatively, 200,000 people, more than the combined populations of Las Cruces and Rio Rancho. You could irrigate about 18,000 acres of cropland with 54,000 acre-feet of water and probably more. So the Medenas must have thought they weren't buying a ranch. They were buying a gold mine. And in 2007, Augustine Plains Ranch applied to the state engineer for a permit to appropriate all 54,000 acre-feet. Unfortunately for the Medenas, however, their application had some serious problems, and we were happy to point that out. Under the law, applications to appropriate, and we're talking about the groundwater code, which was an extension of the 1907 surface water code. Under that law, you have to provide very specific information, including a pretty detailed description of exactly how you're going to beneficially use the water and where that use will occur. Beneficial use, as you all know, is the basis, the measure, and the limit of the right to use water, and in fact, those are the exact words that are written into our state constitution, and they form the heart of the prior appropriation doctrine. After notice of the ranch's application was published, there were about 1,000 protests filed, which is more than any application in the history of the state engineer's office. We represented about 80 protestants. We immediately filed a motion to dismiss based on the legal invalidity of the application because, as I've said, it failed to describe any particular beneficial use. What the application did instead was list several vague schemes that boiled down to this. The ranch was willing to provide water to anyone for any purpose anywhere in seven New Mexico counties, roughly a third of the state of New Mexico. And that area ranged from Santa Fe County up north to Elephant Butte in the south. They wanted to pipe the water into the Rio Grande. They wanted to pipe it up to Santa Fe, or they wanted to just let it go down to Texas for compact compliance. They really weren't picky. Whoever paid for the water, they would sell it to them. And the Medenas were forced to file this kind of vague application because, quite obviously, they didn't have any particular need or use for the water, much less 54,000 acre-feet of water. They just wanted a great deal of water because they thought it would be a good investment. And but for the law of prior appropriation, it would be. Both the state engineer and a district court judge agreed with us that the application should be thrown out because it did violate prior appropriation, which requires an actual beneficial use, and speculation about possible beneficial use is just not legally sufficient to get a water right in New Mexico. At least it's not sufficient yet. Until the Constitution is amended. Thank you.
Oh, you mean you can.
Thanks,
that's
Bruce.
That's a good cutoff line.
I want to interject something very briefly here. 30 years ago or so, I had the enormous pleasure of interviewing Paul Horgan, who was the author of Great River, the Rio Grande in North American History, which remains to me the best history of this region that I know of, at least. And one of the things that Paul Horgan said to me is that culture that came in from the East back in the early part of the 19th century was distinguished by having brought commercialism to New Mexico. And another way of looking at that is that the folks who moved in from the East had a real proclivity for secularizing habitat that was held sacred by the Native American people who lived here. We have had a real proclivity for turning habitat and water into money. On that note, I want to ask friend Peter Pino to speak to us about his perspectives about some of these issues. Peter.
Thank you, Jack. Before I start, I have a question. Again, I'm from Zia Pueblo. How many of you know where Zia Pueblo is at? That's good. A lot of times I ask and two or three hands would go up. The Pueblo of Zia is on the Rio Jemez river system, Rio Jemez watershed. And in 1982, USA versus Abulzaman was filed to adjudicate the water rights on the Rio Jemez. 1983, here he is, 2014, it's still in the courts. That decision hasn't been made. But going back in time, our forefathers were the ones that were responsible for the resources left around the Four Corners area. Mesa Verde, Chaco Canyon, Hovenweep were occupied by not only Zia people, but the other pueblos that remain today. There's 19 pueblos here in the state of New Mexico. Hopi is a sister pueblo that has their villages in Arizona. And one of the reasons why they left Mesa Verde, and before, when they first came into the region, that's where they learned the art of farming. Prior to that, they were hunters and gatherers, and they moved with the game to be able to survive and feed their families. When they got into the Four Corners area, and when I say Four Corners, I'm including what is now Pueblo country, they started to learn the art of farming. And the first farming that they did was dry farming, grid gardens, terraces. Today we have about 2,000 acres of such structures, grids and terraces, northwest of the Pueblo on the present Pueblo of Zia reservation. But the reason why they moved from Mesa Verde, because most of that was dry farming, they realized that it would be beneficial and was beneficial to supplement the rainwater by diverting water from the river and putting that water on the fields that they had planted. And it assured them a bigger and better harvest in the fall. So they settled in different river basins. And of all the tribes in the United States, the Pueblos were the only tribes that were never relocated by the Spaniards, by the Mexican government, and by the U.S. government. Our forefathers chose our homelands, and they chose those homelands because of the availability of surface water, river water, and that's where they settled. And as the Spaniards and some of the other Plains Indians came later, the Pueblos were kind of used like convenience stores. They had the food, they were well established, but instead of coming to barter for some of that food, they just took from the Pueblo people. And when you look at the settlements that came later, they settled close to Pueblos. You look at Isleta to the south. Just south of Isleta is Las Nunas. Then Isleta Pueblo, then you have Albuquerque, then you have Sandia Pueblo, then you have Bernalillo, non-Indian community. And then up the river, you have Santa Ana, Algodones, San Felipe, Santo Domingo, Peña Blanca, Salee, Cochiti. And then when you go up the Jemez River, you have Bernalillo, Santa Ana, Zia, San Isidro, non-Indian community, Jemez Pueblo, and then Cañon and Jemez Springs up into the Jemez Mountains. And when our forefathers first settled, they settled around the foothills of the Jemez Mountains. And when the Hispanics came, they did similarly settle around the foothills of the Jemez Mountains. Because of national security, Los Alamos got put right smack in the middle of the Jemez Mountains. And some of the later villages, like Jemez Springs, La Cueva, went further up into the river basin. And as a result, we started to witness shortages of water, surface flow on the Rio Jemez. And like I said earlier, in 1983, the water adjudication for the Jemez River was filed. And prior to that, we've always had to ration water. And many people speak on the topic of water not ever really irrigating an acre of land, not being real farmers. But they talk about water. The people that know the best about water are the people that are using it at the local level. In 1972, March of that year, I told my mother that my wife Stella and I were going to get married in the fall, September 30th. And my mother told me, well, son, if that's what you're thinking, you got to plant chili and corn and melons, squash, so that you could have fat crop to feed the people that come to help us prepare the food for the reception, for the wedding reception. So ever since 1972, I've been farming to sustain my family. And I know what it is to be short of water. So in 1990, we couldn't ration just within the village because there wasn't enough water. So we called on our neighbors upstream, San Isidro, a non-Indian community, to sit down with us and plan on how we could share the scarce resource. So we did a 5-year agreement, and we went with that agreement, and when it ended, we wanted to sit with them again to do another agreement. And their position was, why are you picking on us? There's Jemez Pueblo, and there's other non-Indian communities up the valley. Why don't you bring in those people and those communities as well? And let's all sit and talk about how we can share this scarce resource. So we sat down. There was attorneys present at that session. And every time somebody came up with an idea, they would interject their thoughts. And they were disruptive to the process. We eventually threw all the attorneys out of the room. Then we sat down with the agreement that we had done in 1990 with San Isidro. And myself and an individual, Gilbert Sandoval from Jemez Springs, went through the document and read each section. And when we read a section, we talked and we modified that agreement so that at the end it encompassed the entire river basin, essentially. And once we came to terms, we called the attorneys back in. We told them that we had reached a decision, and we instructed them to put the documents in legal format. And essentially, we agreed that as Pueblo people, we have senior rights on the waters of the Jemez River. And when the water really went to 17 CFS, the Pueblos could call on the water. And when we called on the water, because we had senior rights, the non-Indians would have to shut down their diversions and allow the water to flow down the river so it could get down to Jemez Pueblo and to Zia Pueblo so that we could irrigate. And they would have to let the water go for six days out of the week. And they would have one day to irrigate their pastures. And we did that over a five-year period. And in 1994, we agreed that we would pull the case from the courts and that we would try to negotiate the rights on the Jemez River through a mediator. From 1994 to 2012, we tried to negotiate the rights out. We could never do it. And the obstacle was the state of New Mexico. Yeah, they had laws, but they had no water rights of their own. They were trying to regulate something that they didn't own, something that they really didn't understand. And yet they were imposing their laws onto the Pueblo. Ownership is key in mainstream society. Ownership was never a concept in Native American culture. We shared with the animals, the birds, all that were here on Earth with us. We had no right to exploit the resources for our benefit. We felt that there was enough to share. And that agreement that we did with the Pueblos and the non-Indians up the Jemez River Valley was, in a sense, based on that kind of a policy, unwritten policy. And we were fine with that. But the state of New Mexico essentially said, you keep changing your mind. You're not set. You make commitments, you make obligations, and you break those obligations. And we felt that we never did that. But in a small session, we told them that, well, we maybe have learned from the best. And then they said, what do you mean? And they said, well, it was your forefathers that broke all the treaties and the agreements that they made, and you're now accusing us that we're not consistent with our commitments and our agreements. I don't think that's true. They said, well, we're through trying to negotiate. We said, okay, fine. So we're back in the courts. And there was just a big hearing on the Rio Jemez adjudication a few weeks ago. But essentially, like I said, ownership is a foreign concept. We're talking about natural law. Natural law says if there's a resource, let everybody partake in that resource. It's because if you start obstructing and denying, then there's impacts in this circle of life. Whatever you do has an impact somewhere in the system. And so we've always been able to be able to share with all living beings, and Europeans are no exception. When your forefathers came, we had a conflict with them, the Spaniards, because they were trying to impose a religion on Pueblo people, and we already had a religion, and that was what the conflict was about. But once our forefathers said, okay, we'll be Catholics, that conflict subsided. And when that happened, we were able to share with one another because we felt that we had enough resources to go around. And when other Europeans came later, that was the same philosophy. But more and more in this society that we live in, we sometimes feel that nice guys finish last. and that shouldn't be. That's going against natural law. And essentially, we feel that we should all be willing to take that kind of philosophy and be able to partake in what nature has put in front of us. Like I was saying, many of the communities built their villages around the foothills of the Haymus Mountains so that nature deposits those resources in the Haymus Mountains. It flows down and comes down to the foothills of the Haymus Mountains so that we could withdraw some of those deposits of resources and be able to share and be able to benefit from, as a community, from the resources that were deposited by Mother Nature. And our religion is based on because we live in a semi-arid region, based on always praying for rain. And I have a difficult time of the state government and the federal government excluding prayer from their proceedings. If you live in a semi-arid region, you always pray for rain, and that doesn't cost anything. We all can pray for that benefit. We have no right to exploit the resources if we really think about sharing this with future generations, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our great-great-grandchildren, yet unborn. So seven generations, three generations back, present generations, and three generations forward. And when you look at that, then you start thinking, well, I shouldn't be too wasteful of this scarce resource. And at least on the surface, the river, you see what water is available. We don't know what water is underneath. People can tell you that there's abundance of water, but we don't know because we can't see underground. And somewhere, if you keep going deeper, we've been taught as Catholics that there's a place called hell. And I've made comments that why do non-Indians want to get down to the brackish water so that they can use it? If they're not too careful, they may tap into hell, and that'll be the end of them. But I don't want to be offensive to anybody. I wanted to put some of this information out there to you as public so that you can think about this kind of things when you leave this session. Our grandfathers or elders have always said, when you have an opportunity to address a group, don't expect to connect with everybody in the room. If you can connect with one person, with one idea, with one concept, with one thought, and the person doesn't have to remember the right the next minute or tomorrow or next week or next month, but if a light bulb goes off 10 years from now, 20 years from now, aha, I get what that person said at the Chemo Theater on May 29th, 2014. I now get it. And if one of you can remember that concept or that idea 10, 20 years from now, then I've communicated. And as a panelist, we've been able to communicate with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. One of my issues that I've been concentrating on for a long time, and I'd mentioned it before the panel began, in which Peter really addressed very well just now, but looking at the relationship between human legislation and natural law, and all too frequently it would seem that human legislation is in violation of natural law, I noticed that one thing that Em alluded to earlier on was that maybe some of those early folks would roll over in their graves if they thought that human use actually had to be shared beyond just the human organism. For example, my friend Bill DeBuise, a friend of many of us here, mentioned to me many years ago that at the beginning of the 20th century, so much of water law was based on the gospel of efficiency. Basically, we were looking at things solely from the point of human use. I mean, the cities of the American Southwest are growing as rapidly as any cities in the United States. And here we are with ever more limited water supplies. And so we can anticipate hard times coming down the pike. And it was like Peter was saying earlier on, thinking in terms of seven generations, three generations in the past, our current generation, and three generations in the future.
The perpetuity definition in water law traditionally has come from the length of a mortgage that it took to capitalize the money to develop the water resource, 30 years.
And so there's a vast difference between 30 years and seven generations.
Yeah, there is.
And so therein lies the conflicting absolutes. We've run out of time.
Oh.
We have, but I really want to thank everybody for coming to this panel. I'm hoping that some of the stuff that we got expressed out here this evening might have taken root. One thing that I would advocate is that we all have to get involved in this. I really do believe in the grassroots. I have infinitely more faith personally in the grassroots than I do from powers on high. And I think that there's a lot of intelligence in the grassroots, and if we do work together and take a big cue from our Native American friends who understand the concept of sharing rather than turning it into money, we might get somewhere. So thank you so much for coming. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And that was Jack Loeffler, M. Hall, Bruce Frederick, and Peter Pino in the fourth in a series of five-panel discussions on water, culture, and climate change in the West, Thinking Like a Watershed, recorded at the Chemo Theater in Albuquerque. The fifth and final panel will address the effect of legislation on the delta of the Colorado River, the Rio Grande watershed, and the Central Arizona Project. The panelists will include John Fleck, science editor for the Albuquerque Journal, Mike Hammond, water administrator and area director for the Bureau of Reclamation, and author and scholar Dr. Sonia Dickey. Please tune in again next week at this time. The panels are funded and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and the Lore of the Land. They are produced and moderated by oral historian, author, and producer Jack Loeffler.